From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I know he had other things in his wardrobe, but it seemed like every time I saw Chase Peterson, he was wearing a crimson V-neck sweater. He loved the University of Utah, and for years he was a constant presence there. He was president, of course, from 1983 to 91, but you could also run into him at the clinic on campus where he helped out, and he never completely gave up his role as a teacher at the medical school. He gave his last lecture there in July. Chase Peterson died on Sunday, and today in the program, we're going to remember him. We're going to replay a conversation with him about the memoir he wrote a few years back. He wasn't sure memoir was the right word to describe the book. His friend, the academic Cornel West, called it a story of passionate curiosity and a profound appreciation of one's roots. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're remembering Chase Peterson, former president of the University of Utah, who died on Sunday from complications of pneumonia. He was 84 years old. In a moment, we're going to replay a conversation we had with Chase Peterson a few years ago when his memoir was published. But I wanted to start by situating Chase Peterson in the community and the culture of Utah, because even though he found himself at the center of some of the state's biggest stories, the artificial heart, of course, the controversy over cold fusion, a lot of us saw him as filling a kind of unofficial role as a public intellectual. Somehow he managed to calibrate reason with faith in a way that always seemed, to me anyway, useful for a place like this. Joining us now on the program is Ted Wilson. Ted, of course, director of the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics for a number of years during Chase Peterson's tenure as the president of the university. He also served as mayor of Salt Lake, of course. These days, he's executive director of UCARE. That's a private nonprofit focused on statewide air quality. And Ted Wilson, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here, Doug. Great subject.
Right? It is. What a guy. Where do you think he fit in the sort of scheme of things, in the culture of a place like this? He was a unique man, I think.
He showed us enthusiasm. And Chase Peterson came to you. You did not have to go to Chase Peterson, whether he was in a room in a meeting. In fact, one day I was in my office at the Hinckley. I get a call from the president's office. I think it was his assistant. And she said, could you meet with the president in about a half an hour? And I said, sure, I'll run right down. She says, oh, no, he's coming to your office. And that was Chase. His spot in the community was to make us enthusiastic about science and the proper role of science in all our deliberations. He gave us – I tried to think of a word this morning when I was coming up and knew you'd ask me these tough questions. He twinkled. And yeah. By that I mean, you know, people that twinkle, that kind of have a face that, again, comes to you. That was Chase Peterson.
Yeah.
And
his eyes would disappear when he smiled, right? The little slits in his eyes.
Yeah. He had a huge intellectual grasp. Yeah. I mean, he went from steely-eyed doctor to Harvard top administrator to running the University of Utah in three giant strides. And in that whole process, I think he showed us that we're not maybe a complete human being until we can grasp a number of subjects and cover a lot of ground. So I think that's what he did for us in so many ways.
What was he like as president? I mean, there was you've talked about how there was some concern when he became president of the university that what's going to happen to sports now? Here's this guy who comes from Harvard, and what's going to happen?
He told me one day, he said, you know, I came out from Harvard, and he says, no one cares about football at Harvard, and unless they're playing Yale, and then they care for one day. And he said, I decided that I would try to diminish a little bit the football program and try to move some of the money that's being expended back into academics and make Utah a presentable but not necessarily winning team, but a strong university. He said, you know, Ted, that lasted about a week. The alumni did not accept that idea well, and I learned we'd better have a good football team. And from that point on, Chase was a rabid football fan. I think he went to all of the games. In fact, I saw him at one of the games in November with one of those classic Ivy League fur coats.
Yeah.
So he adapted quickly to new demands upon him.
What do you think that the cold fusion controversy, and it was a controversy, I mean, some could say it was a debacle, really. What effect do you think that had on Chase Peterson? And we should explain, as you have before, he was a huge believer that this would work, that this was a thing.
I think if Chase had one fault in terms of science and the intellectual application of science, he got too enthusiastic, too excited. And I remember we were at the Hinckley board meeting. Chase was on my board, and we couldn't wait. It was in the middle of the Pons and Fleischmann revelation that they had found cold fusion. And we couldn't wait to say, Chase, what's up? This is cool, right? He said, it's the equivalent of discovery of fire. And I, wow, you know. And we all were caught up in that. And we reflected his enthusiasm. And if anything was a problem, maybe he didn't ask the second and third question, the follow-up question that you news people have to know how to do. You know, how do you follow up on something as revelatory, as totally exciting as that? He told us it was like having a net full of basketballs. And then you try to shove another basketball in, and the net's so tight that you shove energy into this field of neutrons, positrons, or whatever. And he was, as he said that, he just kind of bubbled. And I was so excited. You know, I left that meeting just thinking, you know, the University of Utah may be the biggest achievement since fire. And too bad that we all kind of lost that as certain realities crept into it.
Yeah. How did he take that part?
It was hard. I was out jogging, and we used to run on the same route right above your station here on the Bonneville Scenic Trail. And we'd often run into each other, and we had a habit of stopping and going in either direction and talking for a few minutes. I think we both got tired of running at that point. And it was like a Monday morning, and there had been an awful scene on like Friday where the faculty senate had censured the president because he had, in their mind, made a budget transaction to the new center for cold fusion, and they felt that was breaking normal university procedures. Chase had been traveling all weekend. He had not heard that news. And so I said to him, you know, I said, Chase, are you okay? I heard the news about the censure. And he says, what? And I found myself having to give him the bad news. And I said, well, I'm sorry to be in this position to tell you this, but, you know, your Senate met over the weekend or on Friday and came in and censured you for that. And he just went ashen. And I know that particular incident, losing cold fusion after all the excitement around it, may have been the toughest professional thing in Chase's life. I'm not sure of that. Greta, his wife, would have to tell you that. But it was so hard on him because it was like taking an optimist and just slamming a cleaver into them.
How did he react there on the trail there? What did
he just tightened up and he says, oh, wow. He said, I got work to do, don't I? And he was still a believer at that point. He still believed that Pons and Fleischmann had found something. Now, there is a school of thought still out there that they may have.
Right.
But we didn't. But their measurement was poor, and that's what broke the back of it. And who knows? Maybe someday that particular process will pay off, and Chase will be redeemed.
How would you describe his persona? He never seemed to shy away from the spiritual part of himself. But he never seemed to be in your face with that. I mean, he clearly had a faith. He was an active LDS person, but he also seemed expansive in his sense of spirituality as well. It seemed to me
he had the religion of a Mormon, and the excitement of a Southern Baptist preacher. He refused to take the Mormon culture and make it a barrier to others, as many, and I shouldn't say many, but some Mormons do. They tighten up, they become frosty, they become insular, they sometimes don't share their children in the neighborhood. And we have kind of a tendency to do that in the Mormon faith. But he was like a preacher that wanted to tell you all the good things about the world and save you in ways that were not spiritual. And so he was a great bridge. And he knew how to go up to that legislature and take that Mormon culture that they're very invested with and just kind of slice through it and say, hey, I'm a good Mormon, but here's the deal, folks. This is a real world out there, and we need to operate in it. And he was a master at bringing that culture into line with the greater community, the non-Mormon community, and so forth.
What was he like in his final years, your contact with him in those?
I didn't have a lot of contact with him in the last 10 years. But he was still out doing stuff, working regularly. I know he did a big stint up here at the University Hospital, and then he wound up in working in the clinics for poor people and street people.
Yeah, Fourth Street Clinic. He spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, and he—that was Chase Peterson. You know, his—I don't think he ever retired. And you could ask Greta, his wife, that. But I don't think Chase ever really retired, and he died with his boots on.
Ted Wilson, he is the executive director of UCARE. That's a private nonprofit focused on statewide air quality. Joined us here in the studio. And Ted, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
A few years ago, Chase Peterson learned he had cancer. Didn't end up taking his life, by the way, but the news made him start writing a memoir. Mostly, he said, to displace his sense of panic. Peterson was born and raised in Logan, served as dean of admissions at Harvard College, later as vice president at Harvard University. In 1978, he returned to the West as vice president for health sciences at the University of Utah. In 1983, of course, he became the 11th president of the university, a position he held for some 8 years. The book he finished is not a memoir necessarily from an academic or a physician. He said it was just a collection of stories that shed light on his human and his spiritual journey. The book is called The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. We spoke with him in May of 2012.
You say early in the book that, I guess as you were writing this, that you started to see patterns?
I did. One was the pattern of home. Part of the home is a grandmother who has such fierce determination for her children. The next home was my real home. Dad was president of Utah State Agricultural College, now Utah State University.
Yeah.
And our home was right on campus. And as a 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old kid, I just assumed that I belonged there and I was part of the campus. And I marched with the marching band when they were practicing. The conductor even gave me a baton after a while I could use. I went out with the paint crew to paint. I'd do errands for them. They'd let me paint a little bit here and there. I did it so long, a couple of weeks or months or so, I finally thought I must be on the payroll. And I went to the payroll window at the end of the month. There I was, about 4 feet tall, reaching up to think, my name's Chase Peterson. And he said, we don't see any reference to, are you sure you're employed there? But that didn't bother me. And I went out with the crew that fed the cows and the horses out in North Logan on the days and so forth. People talk about it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Well, that was the village. Let me give you another example of how much part of the village we were. My older sister, by 4, 5, 6 years, walked into a lecture being given by the Danish ambassador. And she and my father were on the stage, and she was talking. My sister walked in with 4 little friends, neighborhood friends, saw Dad on the stage, walked down the aisle, up onto the stage, found empty chairs, and she sat down and hoisted these little kids up onto the chair. And by that time, the audience was snickering a little bit because here the Danish ambassador was talking about the proper approach to the raising of children. And after listening for a short period of time, my sister got off the chair, went over to Dad, and whispered something in his ear. He reached in his pockets, came up with five dimes for the kids to go buy ice cream cones. They put them, they got off their chairs, they walked down, walked up the aisle, went off.
Oh my God.
That's the home.
Yeah.
And when I ended up at age 14 or 15, I had left Utah on a scholarship to go to a prep school in New England. First Utah, first Mormon kid to ever go there.
Yeah.
But as a sophomore at Harvard, where I ended up in college, it was a small class setting Harvard Business School case studies, but not for the economics, but rather the human relationships. And we got to know each other very well, like a tea group, they used to call it in those days. And one day I was walking to class with the professor, and the subject of homesickness came up, and he knew I'd left home when I was 14. And I thought, that's interesting, Professor Cabot. I don't ever remember being homesick. And without a second's pause, said, of course not. You brought your home with you. And that is profound.
Yeah.
To really go far forward, when I was president of the University of Utah, Ted Bell, a wonderful professor of education here, was asked to be Secretary of Education by Reagan. And we gave him the usual leave of absence letter and so forth. But I thought I'd do a personal letter. So I wrote him this letter, said, Dear Ted, I want you to know how much we like you. You can come back tomorrow or 6 weeks from now or 10 years from now, and you've got your position saved here. Well, he stayed there 4 years. And when he came back, I was walking along the campus with him. He said, Oh, Chase, by the way, I meant to tell you something. And he patted his rear pocket, his fanny. He said, I kept your letter in my rear pocket, and I called it my go-to-hell letter, meaning if I was ever being pushed to do things that I didn't believe in by the Washington system, I could tell those birds back there, to hell with you, I'm going back to the University of Utah. And he said, it allowed me to be more of who I was and allowed me to be a better Secretary of Education. Mm. So that's what home began to be. It was not restricting. It wasn't something that held me in. It's something that liberated me.
Was it a pretty conventional religious upbringing? Your family was pretty Orthodox Mormon in many ways, but it seems like they had a kind of here as well. It seems like, because you write about it in the book, you say that it didn't seem terribly puritanical, for example, your brand of faith. And it seemed like you said you took the ideas of free agency and individuality, which you say gave you space to explore your faith.
Absolutely. I had space. I never felt constricted. Two quick stories then. My father off and on taught a Sunday school class while he was president. He came home one Sunday. I was 10, 11 years old. And he chuckled to me. He said, son, Chase, whatever he called me, don't ever sell short a church that puts each individual in charge of their own salvation. He said, at Sunday school today, before we could start the lesson, a man at the back of the room raised his hand, said, Brother Peterson, I'd like to tell you that I've been thinking about our discussion last week, and I've been studying it, and I've been reading about it, and I've been praying, and I've decided that the Lord was right. That's sacrilegious, I suppose. But Dad just said, don't underestimate a faith that puts that responsibility. And this guy, by the way, was not a professor of philosophy.
Yeah.
He was a janitor of the local bank. Then later, I remember an episode where my mother and my sister, the same sister that got the ice cream cone, had gone to a state conference, the annual meeting of the Mormon Church. And one of the talks was hell and damnation.
Yeah.
And my sister at age 14 was bristling about that and the harshness of it and so forth and complained to mother. And I was walking with them. I probably hadn't even listened to it very much. And mother said, well, she said, I don't think I needed that today, but probably someone did. In other words, you're obliged to pick and choose, not discard or as a cafeteria, but choose. And she used to quote to me in letters when I was back in Boston as a young student by a German philosopher, Albert Schweitzer. He said, one must first study the program in every way you can, from all angles and from all degrees. And when you've studied all you can, then you should pray about the matter, quiet the mind, and await the inspiration for which your study and your prayer has prepared you. Well, now, that's the religion I grew up in and still have, and it's a very powerful one.
Did you know what you wanted for your life early on? Did you map out a trajectory, you know, like a journey, a plan for yourself?
Absolutely not.
No?
Never had any ideas of becoming the plumber or the aircraft pilot or anything else. My mother came down with a osteomyelitis, infection of her bone, of her thigh, of her shin, before I was born. She lived in Lake Town. All they could promise her was amputation of the leg to save her life. She was about 12 or 15 or something. And she said, no, I'm going to keep my leg and we'll find a way to get through this. Well, the infection went into a quiescent stage, which happens with bone infections sometimes. They've taken mummies from Egypt and chewed up the bones they find, and they can find living bacteria still hiding in these bones. But at age 34 or 5, it erupted again and broke out and actually broke through the skin. And she had exposed bone, shin bone there. When I was born, my memory is her propped up on the couch, her leg up. She would clean out the wound every day, dress it, even occasionally pick out spicules of dead bone to keep the thing cleaner. And she'd pat her leg and say, "My old friend." And she'd walked without a limp to speak of that I noticed, and it was there till the day she died. So that must have given me unconsciously some sense of that medicine was interesting. Medicine could be optimistic. Medicine could be forward-thinking. And that may have influenced me. I also was reasonably good in the sciences in school, so I guess that encouraged me.
But she always told you, don't forget who you are.
Oh, bless her heart. From the earliest age, she used to say, "Chase boy, never forget who you are." And I didn't puzzle by that. I didn't really contemplate it because you don't contemplate things when you're 6 and 7 years old. But I never really knew what she meant because I didn't know who I was. But I did get the impression no one else will define you. You define yourself. And that's powerful.
Late spring of 1945, there came, you referenced it earlier, I wanted you to talk about it. It was this turning point in your life. You had received this kind of on a whim. You had taken this test.
I was in the ninth grade of junior high school. The principal came up and said, "Chase, well, I'd be interested to have you take a test. There's a school back east that wants some of our kids to take a test." For some reason, I didn't really know what. There was no obligation. I said, "Sure, I'd like to take tests. I'll do it."
Right.
A month later, a telegram arrived, which itself was quite an event in those days. You know, they were delivered by the little telegraph person with a hat on, that I'd been awarded a scholarship to Middlesex School in Concord, Massachusetts. And I thought about it, and I looked about it. And Dad was leaving the college just that year.
Yeah.
And I sensed that money was a little shut tight. We'd lived in a college home all his years, so we had no equity in a home to live in. They had to buy a new home to live in. His retirement fund couldn't have grown very well during the Depression. That was most of his presidency. And I just sensed that things were a bit tight, and even though I had a full scholarship, there'd still be expensive money to travel back and forth. And for that reason, and maybe others, I decided not to go. He had a letter written by his secretary to thank the school and decline them with appreciation. He came over. He leaned against the mantle of our fireplace in our house. I'll never forget that scene. He said, "Let me read the letter, Chase, and see if it's okay." And he read this letter describing the decline. He looked at me and said, "Are you sure you don't want to go?" And for reasons I didn't understand then, nor do I understand it now, I took a deep breath and said, "Dad, as a matter of fact, I do want to go." And that dear man tore up the letter in front of me, just zoop, tore it up. He didn't say, "Are you sure?" or "Do you want to think about it?" or "Watch out for the painted ladies in Chicago when you go through on the train." If that wasn't a vote of confidence for a 14, 15-year-old kid, I'd like to know what was. And I look back to realize that I was never going to let my dad down or my mother down. And I went back. I thought I was Brigham Young going east. As the first Mormon and first Utah to ever go to this school, I didn't really know what being a Mormon was at that age. But whatever it was, I was not going to embarrass him. And that began my self-discovery.
Chase Peterson. We spoke with him back in 2012 about his book, The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. Dr. Peterson died on Sunday. He was 84 years old. The funeral services will be held Saturday, September 27th at the Monument Park Stake Center in Salt Lake City. You can find details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Chase Peterson. He joined us a few years ago to talk about his book, The Guardian Poplar. Peterson died on Sunday. I'm just going to throw you, lob you some opportunities to tell these stories, which is that's what it's all about. I wanted you talk about in the book how Harvard sort of set the stage for you considering your faith. But you say that there were these two forces that converged during your sophomore year at the school. One was this desire to, as you put it in the book, investigate the meaning of faith. And then there was that social pain of stuttering. You write about having begun stuttering, really, for some reason in the eighth or ninth grade, and this caused you some pain. And so you were sort of working through those two things. Talk about that.
Well, and there's a third thing, too. There was a man named Edward Ted Eyring, father of the current leader of the LDS Church, who was a professor of chemistry at Princeton. And he would come to Boston from time to time and meet with young LDS students, sort of fireside. And he made the simple point that there is no conflict between faith and reason. If there is, you haven't worked hard enough. And that's what he felt like as a chemist and so forth. Well, by the time I was a sophomore, I had been a passive, drifting Mormon, if you want to call it that. And I thought, come on, Peterson, it's time you better investigate this thing and make this your own or get rid of it.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'd been stuttering rather badly for the last 4 or 5 years for reasons I don't understand entirely. Doesn't really matter. But stuttering is a painful thing. Oh, you raise your hand in class, then you pull it down for fear that you won't be able to answer. In the dormitory, they holler, Peterson, phone. And you come down two flights of stairs to the payphone at the bottom of the dormitory. When you got to that payphone, you had to reach out for that damnable phone and say, ha, 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 hello. I learned the trick of going down the stairs doing calculus in my head, and I'd bump into the phone, grab it, and say hello. Wow. Before I lost my courage.
Because hello is particularly hard to say.
It is. It's a hello word. And so that combined with this determination to investigate what the meaning of faith was. And I remember, and I don't mean to sound too sweet or too pompous or anything else about this, but it's my life. I knelt down and prayed by the side of my bed in Winthrop House at Harvard College. And I said, Dear Lord, if you exist, and if we're on this earth to improve ourselves and to expand and grow, stuttering is an inefficient way for me to have to operate. Would you please help me find a way out of stuttering? Amen. I woke up the next morning. I've never stuttered since. Now, I'm enough of a neuroscientist to know what positive thinking can do and what a lot of different things and what brain channeling can do and so forth. We learned a lot about the fact that the brain kind of really remolds itself in response to the thoughts. Good thoughts create other better thoughts. But whatever it was, the stuttering disappeared. And that same faith that my sister and mother had, choosing the power of what could be there in the mind as well as the spirit, was with me, and it's been a very powerful thing ever since. Mm.
So you don't see that conflict between reason and faith?
No. As a member of the church, I have disagreed with things that have gone on in the church. The church is fairly radical when you think about the fact that we approved birth control many, many decades ago. The Republican Party is still fighting about it, apparently, in those debates. as if it's some kind of a thing that would allow women to have. Birth control and family planning is part of accepted practice in the LDS Church. I wasn't comfortable with our prohibition of blacks not getting the priesthood.
Let me hold you right there because I want to ask you something about that. You this was when you were in Boston, of course, and you'd been asked to be on what they call in LDS Church a stake high council.
Yeah.
But you had, as you said, you didn't agree with this position. You didn't know what to make of it. You had, I guess, pretty conflicted feelings about all of that. This was the prohibition of the LDS priesthood to men of color. But they asked you to be on this high council. And what did you say? It's an interesting response.
I went to the high council, head of the high council, and said I'd be honored to be on the high council with you. But you need to understand that I don't understand, and to the degree I do, I don't agree with our position. I think it will be changing in the church on the black priesthood matter. I'm not going to picket the church. I'm not going to burn buildings down. I'm not going to do those things. But I do want my understood that in discussions about that matter, I intend to be open and frank about it. If you would like me to be on the High Council with that attitude, I'd be honored to do so. He said, Chase, I'd be honored to have you on there. You'd be surprised how many people agree with you. And so that's where it was. Later on, I became a branch president. Yeah. And we had missionaries coming back from South America, Brazil, and places. And they said, we can't tell who's black. Everyone is black in Brazil. They've mixed up races and so forth. How can we live with this sort of thing? And President Kimball at that time had been battling, or as Schweitzer would say, studying from every way he could, discussing things with people from Africa about this position, praying in the temple hour after hour after hour for guidance and what would be inspiration and revelation on this matter. As a group of people in this little branch, we wrote a letter to him, a polite, humble letter saying, laying out a position, saying why we thought it might change and why it could change.
What did it say? What did the letter say?
Well, we just said we think that we are a progressive church and the Lord is revealing new things to us and we're growing and expanding. And we hope that your prayers would be answered and you'd find reasons to figure we could move on in some fashion. I wrote that in April and I got a letter back a week later. Dear Brother Peterson, I've received your letter and I appreciate it. That's all he said. And then they announced the revelation on June 8th that year. And I got a letter from him a week later. Dear Brother Peterson, I assume you've heard the news and are as pleased as I am. And I say, that's important. He was pleased to get the revelation. He wasn't someone pushing him. We weren't a bunch of nutheads in Cambridge pushing. He wouldn't respond to that, and we weren't doing that. But these good folks were praying, and he later said, prayer does not come to people lying on couches. You've got to work for your answers to your prayer. And he had worked and worked and worked and worked and satisfied himself and then satisfied his brethren.
How did you explain that position, that this was a group of fallible men who misconstrued the will of God?
This is historical inertia. Huh. The church began in the middle part of America. Slavery was an issue at that time. It was a hot issue, and that was just the customs of the time. And we moved west. The custom came with us, and there it was. Some people raised theoretical reasons why the black person couldn't get a thing, but none of them were convincing, and President Kimball never felt they were. It was evolution. And if you believe in a loving God who believes in the development and growth of his children, so to speak, that's entirely appropriate.
I want to ask you about when you decided, this comes before this, but when you decided you wanted to be a doctor, making that call, what was the clincher for you? You reflected back on your mother's experience and there was something there, but what was the thing that made you decide this was what you wanted to do?
I don't know. And we asked people that apply to medical school, tell us why you want to go to medical school in essays, and I don't know what I would have written. I was pretty good in the sciences. I saw in medicine a field which had intense human relationships, which I found attractive, the promise of that. It was obviously a good, a do-gooding thing. It wasn't tearing down society. It was building up individuals. So it just seemed like a logical thing to do. And I didn't decide until I was a junior in college. I stayed over in the summer and took the summer school courses and then applied the next year and was admitted.
What was the other option? Was there another
Can't think of any.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, can't think of any. Just seemed natural. And it, I had to work very hard. I was not a science major, and some of my classmates were practically PhDs in biochemistry. But that was a good challenge, and that was all right.
You know, it's interesting, Chase, to hear you talk about science in the context of relationships. And having spoken with you before, there's always some bit of art that you're thinking of. There's music and there's literature, and it's all, which is interesting for some scientists, I think.
Well, absolutely. I mean, music, we've discovered music influences the brain. I've gone down to the Utah Symphony some Friday evening, tired, worn out. Sometimes I get jittery legs when I get really tired and so forth. And a Shostakovich symphony came on, something I hadn't heard before. I wouldn't be naturally a fan of his. It's a little bit too modern for me. And that thing just took me over. It absolutely overwhelmed me. And it went on, and I was just part of it by the time it was over. So music's part of it. I've had the great privilege of being able to work with medical students since I left the presidency. And I advise them to do two special little things, please. One, when you examine a patient, touch them. Some people treat a patient like a septic, something that they hold out at a distance and push the stethoscope out on their chest to listen to the lung. Put your hand on their shoulder, not in a vulgar way, but just let you know there's a human bond there. Secondly, learn something non-medical from each patient you see. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, the more you know about a patient, the more you can relate that to what their medical symptoms are. But furthermore, well, it is also fun to learn. Yeah. You see all these patients, you learn an enormous amount of new things. But most importantly, the patient says, He's bonding with me. He's listening to me enough to understand, try to understand who I am and where I come from. And if he's willing to learn from me, then I better be willing to learn from him when he prescribes medicines and different procedures to follow. So that's the human side of medicine. And it happens to be good humanity, and it's very good science.
As we head into a break, I wanted to ask you, what is it about Mahler's Second Symphony that inspires you so much, the Resurrection?
I went there alone one night. My wife was on a trip with some friends into Nevada on a discussion they were having. I never heard this Mahler symphony before, but it was deep and it was probing, and it just enveloped me in ways that I can't describe in words. I remember leaving, and as I left, there was a man seeking funds, a beggar outside, and I remember I gave him some coins from my left pocket. And when I got home, I thought, why didn't I give him that $5 bill I had in my right pocket? I just don't know. But at any rate, I got home and my wife, Greta, was gone. She was in Nevada. And I woke up the next morning lonely, just deeply lonely in the absence of Greta, thinking that somehow there might be something almost ultimately permanent because one of us would die and we might be separated. And I just came to feel that night, inspired by Mahler, that love cannot exist without the potential for loneliness. The more you love someone, the more lonely you are in their absence. And it deeply impressed me and deeply rebound myself to the love that I have for Greta and I believe Greta has for me. But it was triggered by Mahler.
Yeah.
And the symphony. Music is neurological as well. All cultures have music. They're all influenced that way. I could never live in a town that didn't have a symphony.
Music.
Chase Peterson. His book is The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. Dr. Peterson died on Sunday. He was 84 years old. Funeral services will be held Saturday, September 27th, at the Monument Park Stake Center in Salt Lake City. There's more information on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We return now to our conversation with Dr. Chase Peterson. We spoke with him in May of 2012. He had just published a memoir called The Guardian Poplar. Peterson died on Sunday. He was 84. Why did you want to be president of the University of Utah? Somebody put that question to you. You thought that was a pretty good question.
I've answered, I don't know, about five of your questions so far, Doug, and this was another one. I had huge respect for a university. Obert Tanner used to say that the university is the highest element of human development or something like that. It's a place where you preserved old knowledge and you gained new knowledge. And to be involved in that was just an enormous privilege. And so I think I kind of took a deep breath and said, I wonder if I can do it. And I decided, yeah, I can do it. And off we went.
You tell of receiving, this is the first month or so into the job, and you tell in the book about receiving this phone call, someone who mentioned that, President Peterson, there's a problem. There's a gay lesbian conference that's being planned for the campus, and, you know, what do you plan on doing about it?
Well, you see, you ask yourself, what power does the president have? Not much. I didn't have stock dividends I could give anybody. I couldn't put someone in jail. You had the bully pulpit. And I remember getting that phone call. I think very quickly, Peterson, this is a big thing. You better think this through clearly right now. So I turned to this on the phone and said, well, let me think of what options do I have. I suppose I could find the names of the students who were organizing the conference and have them fired from the university. But they'd sue me immediately and be back quickly. Or I could find some faculty members might have been coaching them. And I could have them fired from their tenure, but they'd sue and win quickly and be back. Now, it's not against the law to practice homosexuality or heterosexuality with consenting adults. It's against the law to do it on the front lawn of the park building, but it's not by themselves. I went on with a few more options. And finally, there was a pause, and this fellow said, well, maybe the best thing might be to do nothing. And I deliberately paused for a moment and said, you know, that's probably the right answer. Well, the university had a perfectly decent discussion period, a convocation, if you want, on that issue. It deserved discussion. No one was seduced by it one way or the other. And it went on fine. But the university is a bastion of free speech. And that's where people have to be able to talk about ideas and not be afraid of them. And this was one of them.
Yeah. The cold fusion controversy, you write up a great deal about this in the book. And you mentioned that the criticism that accompanied all of that, the story itself, it became to some quite embarrassing for the university. And you say it kind of triggered a fear on the campus for some. What was going on, do you think?
It
did. How do
you explain it? Well, if excess heat was being produced by the Pons-Weissman phenomenon, they didn't know why, and no one knew why. There was conjecture that it was some newer form of nuclear fusion, but you couldn't really explain it. And so it violated the laws. And people that were in charge of maintaining standards, so to speak, rose up and said, this is nonsense. And this is an example of conjugate principles. That is, two important principles in collision. One is free speech, and the right to write what you believe. And the other is the need to maintain order in science and not have every cockamamie idea come out in the newspapers the next day saying that tomato juice will cure athlete's foot. So you see a collision there. And so the people in charge of maintaining order felt they had to speak out and be against it. There was also a political issue. Hot fusion was being studied intensively by the research community in the hopes of reproducing the conditions on the sun that could then provide power for this Earth. There had been no breakthroughs, and it was being funded year by year by Congress. And obviously, some people, I learned from them, felt very threatened that if some cold fusion thing came along that could be done cheaply, it might threaten the funding of hot fusion. Even the head of the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge, I met with him one time on another reason. And I finally asked him, what will it take to get the study of cold fusion into the mainstream of science? And he looked at me and smiled in a kind of a sly way and said, the hot fusion industry has a very strong lobby. And that's all it was said. Well, we still don't know what it is. Yeah. Hundreds of labs have reproduced the heat. No one still knows exactly why, and no one has been able to produce it commercially, although a number of laboratories from here to Israel and back are working on it very hard. But it's the phenomenon of the heat is real. And right as of today at MIT, there's a professor at MIT who for a long while has been trying to figure out what the mechanism might be that would explain the extra heat. And he's giving a course now unofficially at MIT on considering different possibilities. MIT insists it be unofficial, but he's doing it.
The university's faculty senate passed a resolution of I'm not sure exactly no confidence, but that's what you've sort of seemed to it was expressing a kind of a displeasure about how you were handling the matter. And you talk about that being a trigger for you to leave.
The university was a lot of people did their best to embarrass the university for this outrageous thing that they're proposing. And a lot of people were sensitive about that. They thought the university might be harmed. Incidentally, the evidence is no harm at all. The amount of research we were doing in that year was something like $120 million. We're now doing $400 million worth of research per year, funded research from the national thing. Our recruitment of faculty had never been better, so there's been no harm. But at the time, there are a lot of people that were chagrined and a little embarrassed. And people laughed at Hick, Utah out there. One man even said, I tend to be suspicious of scientific information that comes out of the Vatican or Salt Lake City. So that was all there. And so I had found myself in a position where I felt I had to say certain things. I was asked to testify at Congress about this matter. And incidentally, the man opened the hearing at Congress saying, the announcement here was orthodox. It was not preceded by peer review. Well, it was, and that was held against us. It was peer-reviewed, but it was peer-reviewed in the Journal of Electroanalytic Chemistry, which was the journal that Fleischmann related to. And that didn't count if it was doing something that the physics community should be doing by itself. So anyway, the battle was going on. There was no real way to wipe away the turmoil. It was distracting from what was going. I've been at the university a good while. I was 1 year away from retiring, and I came home and said, Greta, I think it's probably time for us to move on. Not with bitterness or anything else, but great appreciation, quite frankly. And so we announced that I was going to retire, but I would retire a year from now, giving them a full year to find a good new man to replace me. And I think it's worked out just fine.
Did you feel hurt?
A little.
Yeah.
I'm human. I'd like everyone to love me, and some people were mad at me. But at the same time, free speech has never sailed on tranquil waters. There's usually a few waves to bump up against.
I want to come back around, as you do, to this idea of, you know, you come back around where you started, and there's a reference to T.S. Eliot. I wanted you to talk about this in the book. Read this section, if you would, from your book.
Well, as I intimated, the writing of the book was a discovery process for me. I discovered more about myself, about my ancestors, about grandparents that homesteaded land in Bear Lake. I worked there every summer. And so this was a moment of – this was a process of discovery for which I was grateful. But I became so overwhelmingly moved by the power of the sense of home – and the power of the sense of culture, why did those things not restrict me?
Yeah.
And this is how I end the book, if I may read it. My journey includes the way, as a doctor, I became a patient. That was the cancer that had me disturbed for a while. The milestones are both institutions and people. The institutions enriched me and provided a platform for my ideas, while they challenged me to remember who I was apart from them. As with the first pulse, the end of my journey returns to my parents and our family's deep roots. This starting place, Logan, Utah, informs the beginning, the course, and the end of my story. T.S. Eliot's familiar line says as much, "And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." This leads me to ask, did deep roots shrink or enlarge opportunity, dampen or strengthen courage? Did they narrow or broaden curiosity or imagination? Did they constrain or free the mind and spirit? I hope those who read these stories will find the answer, if not mine, then their own.
Chase Peterson, from our interview in May of 2012, he died on Sunday at the age of 84. I got a letter from Chase a few months after that show. He wanted to say thanks. Thanks, he wrote, from the depth of my heart and from whatever dimension there is to my mind. He said he liked the idea of us replaying interviews like that one. In his typically elegant way, he said, "The notion amounts to the essence of immortality, at least immortality of the mind and spirit." I have come to think, he wrote, that there is no greater favor or achievement that can be extended or shared with another than to truly understand them or their parts. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.